Well, it is great to be with you. Normally when you go to preach, they give you a bottle of water at the front of the church, but I see I've got Coke today, so I'm not sure whether I dare open it yet. Talking about Coke, actually, funny story. Years ago, when I first started working with university students, I was invited to go and do a mission in Preston at the University of Central Lancashire. And the group were doing their first week, and it was one of those weeks where they had no kind of previous experience. They did all sorts of things wrong, but it was great fun. And we had a curry night one night, and it was in a place called Passion Palace, which sounded a little bit dodgy. And it was, apparently this was normally used as a strip club, but they used it. Thankfully, no naked women were there that night for a curry night. And so we went to this event, and I preached on John chapter 3. But I always remember the guy who was serving us that night was from Iraq, who's from a Muslim background. And he was there behind the bar, and he was fascinated by what he heard about Jesus. And afterwards, I had this very long conversation where he kept serving me Coke, but his Coke machine had broken, so it was basically serving me the neat syrup that probably had a very, very high caffeine content. So by the end of this conversation, I was really hyper. But wonderfully, he did come to know Jesus and joined the local church, which was fantastic. So Coke is obviously the thing to drink when you're sharing the gospel. But also, isn't it great? God's timing. I just love, in lots of ways, God's timing. Firstly, it's wonderful that we were able to come to Cornwall. It just worked out that actually we were going to be homeless, so it was quite useful to be here for a couple of weeks. Secondly, wonderful to meet Gabriel, and we look forward to meeting him in Leicester. If you're watching, don't know where I look. Look forward to seeing you up there. And also wonderful that in this series that you're looking at as a church, on these different values that you have, that we can look together this morning at being mission-minded. And obviously that's something, well, I hope is close to all of our hearts, but it's something that's close to ours. So we're going to look at Luke 19 together to do that, a story that Rebecca read to us just now. And it's a familiar story, isn't it, if you've grown up in church or if you ever went to Sunday school or something like that. I don't know, perhaps the story of Zacchaeus is the most familiar of all the stories, because it's this quite fun story of this little man Zacchaeus climbing the sycamore fig tree. And I won't break into song, but I'm tempted this morning to sing about Zacchaeus, the wee little man. The wee little man was he. And it's a familiar story, but because it's a familiar story, sometimes we can almost put it in the category of kind of make-believe children's fairy stories, can't we? And I was struck reading a fascinating book recently by Peter Williams, the New Testament scholar, who's written a really good book on why we can trust the Gospels as historically reliable. And one of the many things that he points out in that book is this story, in fact. And he says, isn't it interesting that Zacchaeus climbs a sycamore fig tree? And most of us probably aren't particularly keen on the botany of the Middle East, but apparently this type of tree only grows in this particular part of the world. If you go north to Turkey or south to Egypt, you won't find this type of tree. And he says, in all of these little details, the gospel writers got it right. If you were making up a story, you know, years later in a different part of the world, these are the kind of things that you would get wrong. And yet, again and again, in the details of the plants and the buildings and the places and the names, Luke and the other gospel writers got the details right. So remember this morning, we're not just looking at a familiar story. We're looking at a historical story, something that really happens, real history. This is documented. But it's also, I want to suggest this morning, a surprising story. A surprising story for at least two reasons. Firstly, it's a surprising story because it's a story of how Zacchaeus is interested in Jesus. And actually, as we'll see, Zacchaeus probably isn't the kind of person you'd expect, at least initially, to be interested in Jesus. We know that Zacchaeus was a tax collector, not just a tax collector, but the boss of the tax collectors, a chief tax collector. And it's common to kind of associate tax collectors of the first century with traffic wardens of the 21st century, isn't it? Kind of a profession which isn't particularly liked. But actually, I think that does traffic wardens a bit of a disservice because they're only doing their job. Tax collectors were far more despised in the first century than traffic wardens are ever despised in our culture today, okay? Why? Well, for at least two reasons. Firstly, because they were seen as traitors. The Jews were living in a land that was occupied by the Romans. And to be a tax collector, you had colluded with the occupying powers to fleece your own people. And so Zacchaeus was one of these guys who had basically put all his principles, you know, sold out to all his principles to get rich. And he had probably cheated people in the process, because that was kind of common practice, that you would get really wealthy by taking a little bit extra for yourself as well as for the Romans. So when you think of Zacchaeus, don't think of traffic warden, think maybe loan shark. You know, think of someone who really is despised in our culture. And yet, Zacchaeus is keen to see Jesus, isn't he? In fact, he's so keen to see Jesus, he's willing to climb a tree, which in that culture, for a grown man to climb a tree would have been very undignifying. He was willing to throw his dignity out the window so he could just get a glimpse of Jesus. And here's the thing that you see as you go through Luke's gospel particularly. The people you would expect to be interested in Jesus aren't, and the people you don't expect to be interested in Jesus are. You see that even in chapters 18 and 19, don't you? If you just glance through just the headings. You know, you get the Pharisee in the story of the Pharisee and tax collector. He's the one that misses out. You've got the rich, respectable man in chapter 18 who goes away empty. But you've got the blind beggar, the persistent widow, and the tax collector. Maybe Zacchaeus had heard the story, passed on. Maybe that's why he was interested. Who seem to be in with Jesus. So the people you think are in are out, and the people you think are out are in. And that's again and again the way it is with Jesus. The moral, the respectable, the religious seem to be offended by Jesus, by his claims, by his demands. The irreligious, the immoral, the outcasts are intrigued by Jesus and drawn to his compassion and his love. I think there's a big lesson for that, because I don't know about you, but I am tempted very often to make assumptions about who I think might be most interested in Jesus and most close to becoming a Christian, and other people who I think wouldn't be, okay? I guess we all do it, don't we? And again, despite the fact I know the scriptures, I do that. And again, I'm surprised because I'm wrong. I'll give you two examples. We've been living, as I say, in Marlow in Buckinghamshire, and in lockdown, there's not a lot of people you can get to know, but living in a block of flats, your neighbours at least are people you can get to know. And we've got had communal gardens, which are great to be able to chat to people and to be able to spend time with people in those gardens. And we were probably about half the age of most of the neighbours in our flats. But the oldest resident in our flats, who had her 90th birthday, was someone that we chatted to quite a bit out in the gardens, having kind of evening drinks together. And I remember before I really got to know much about our neighbour, I thought if any of our neighbours is going to be kind of warm towards the Christian faith, it's going to be her. She's 90. She's bound to go to a kind of Church of England church at least twice a year. She's bound to have some kind of nominal belief in God. She, you know, just look at her. She's so lovely. And yet, as we got chatting, it turned out she was the most hardened atheist of the lot. She was absolutely, completely, and totally opposed to the Christian faith. Now, we had some wonderfully interesting conversations, and she heard me preach a few times online, but we had this weird situation where I would go inside after talking to her, preach to my camera in my study, and then come back outside and talk to her about the talk that she had listened to, hosted by a church in a different country. Such was the wonder of Zoom. But here's the point. I thought, oh, she's going to be kind of like really close, but she wasn't. A few years before, actually, in that mission week in Preston that I mentioned, I remember speaking at a lunchtime event, and it was in the main student union. And because of that, there were lots of people who passed through who wouldn't have necessarily been invited, but just were there because it was a public building. And afterwards, I was walking across the main quadrangle of the university, and there was a group of lads who looked kind of like quite hard. And they were all kind of chatting together. And I was just walking along, minding my own business. And then one of them saw me and shouted really loud and said, "Oi, you!" And I thought, maybe they're talking to me. But by the looks of them, I kind of hoped they weren't. So I just kept walking. And then he shouted again, "Oi, you!" So I turned around and said, "Me?" He said, "Yes." And then he said, "Were you the one giving that talk earlier in the student union?" And I thought, maybe this is the time to lie and pretend it was my twin brother that I don't have. Because I was really scared about what they might say next. But I didn't lie. I told the truth. And I said, "Yes, it was me." And then I waited in trepidation for what they were about to say. And then he said, "It was really interesting. Can we talk more?" And then we stood and we had this amazing conversation. And they were really open to the Christian faith. And again, I'm so surprised because I come up with kind of preconceived ideas. I think they'll be interested. I don't think they will be. They'll be close to the Christian faith. They're not. And what we are reminded by this passage and the whole of the Gospels is that we're not to judge, are we? We're not to kind of come up with our preconceived ideas. Do we sometimes hold back on speaking to some people because we think they're so unlike us? Or we think they won't be interested? Maybe we need to be challenged by that. I'm reminded so often that actually it's not people's reluctance to hear about Jesus that stops evangelism from happening. So often it's our reluctance to talk to them because we've already decided that they won't be interested. Now, of course, sometimes they're not, okay? And that's the problem. Sometimes we do talk and people aren't interested, or maybe even worse, they just react negatively. But don't decide for them. Don't come up with a decision that they're not going to be interested without even trying. Zacchaeus is interested, and we may be surprised by the people around us who are more open than we might think, particularly after the last year that we've had. So let's take the opportunities. So that's the first surprise, okay? Zacchaeus is interested in Jesus. He's not the kind of guy you'd expect. But here's surprise number two in the story, and that is this. Jesus is interested in Zacchaeus. He's not just interested in the religious. He's interested in people like Zacchaeus. In fact, in this crowd of people, he singles Zacchaeus out, doesn't he? He notices him up the tree, and he invites himself for dinner, which I always thought was a little bit rude. Now, I'm coming to your house for tea. Now, of course, in English culture, that might be a little bit rude, but in the first century culture in which Jesus is operating, that would have been incredibly dignifying for Zacchaeus. To go to someone's house and to receive hospitality was to treat them with dignity and respect. In fact, in some cultures, that's still the case today. Tim and Joyce and I went to Romania quite a few times. I remember particularly working in some of the very, very poor communities. The incredible welcome we received in some people's houses when they went to great effort to put food before us, food that they could barely afford, and was humbled by the fact that they treated us with such dignity because they actually saw this as a great, great opportunity to host visitors from the West. This is what's happening here. Jesus, by inviting himself over, is treating Zacchaeus with dignity. Now, what's interesting is the crowd's reaction, because what do they say? Verse 7, all the people saw this and they began to mutter, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. They don't think that Jesus should be going to Zacchaeus' house. And yet, what's Jesus' response? Verse 10, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. In other words, Zacchaeus is exactly the kind of person that I've come for. Okay? Now, interestingly, contrast how the crowd look at Zacchaeus with how Jesus looks at Zacchaeus. Verse 7, the crowd look at Zacchaeus and they say, he is a sinner. Now, that's true, actually, isn't it? He is a sinner, but so were they. But you get the sense in the way they say it that they're speaking in judgments, as if it's only Zacchaeus that's a sinner and not them. But interestingly, Jesus doesn't call him a sinner, even though he is. Jesus infers in verse 10 that Zacchaeus is lost. I find that really interesting, the difference. The crowd look at Zacchaeus with an attitude of judgment, but Jesus looks at Zacchaeus with an attitude of compassion. And it makes me think, how do we look at the world around us as Christians, if we know Jesus? When we look at a world that often is very opposed to Jesus, his message, and all that the Christian faith stands for. Do we look at the world around us in an attitude of judgment or with an attitude of compassion? Are we more like the crowd or are we more like Jesus? How do we view people? John Wesley, famous preacher, wrote in his journals once of a trip he took to Newcastle. And it's very fascinating because he talks about this journey to Newcastle and he says he walked around the city on his arrival and he says, so much debauchery, so much drunkenness, so much immorality. A friend of mine said, well, not much has changed in Newcastle. But he says, you know, so much sin. But then he says, surely this place is ripe for... dot, dot, dot. What do you think he's going to say? You think he's going to say, surely this place is ripe for judgments. But he says, surely this place is ripe for he who came not to call the righteous sinners to repentance. You know, he looked at this city with all the darkness and all the sin. He says, actually, this place is ripe for Jesus. Yeah, I don't know about you, but sometimes as we look at the culture in which we live, I'm really saddened by the direction that our culture seems to be going in, by things that are happening, by attitudes that I see. But how do I respond to that? Is it in judgment or is it in compassion? Do I say this place is ripe for judgment, or do I say it's ripe for the one who came for the lost, for Jesus? How do we respond? And then notice, not only does Jesus see this man not primarily identified as a sinner but lost, but also notice that he sees not only what he is but what he's going to become. Verse 9, Jesus said, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. For us, of course, that seems like a strange thing, but for Zacchaeus, that would have been an amazing thing to hear. As a Jew who had colluded with the Romans, the crowd would have assumed that this guy had lost any right to call himself part of God's people. And yet Jesus says, now actually, truly, Zacchaeus has become part of God's people. He's a son of Abraham. Jesus doesn't just see what Zacchaeus is, but he sees what Zacchaeus is going to become. And again, as we interact with people, it's very easy to see who people are, isn't it? But can we also, with the eyes of faith, see what people could become when they encounter Jesus? Because Jesus is in the habit of changing people's lives, isn't he? He's changed our lives. And he can change other people's lives. Never forget, a few years ago, meeting a guy called Tom Tarrant in Oxford. Tom is in his 60s, 70s now, I guess. And he's a lovely, gentle man, heads up the C.S. Lewis Institute in America. Incredibly gracious man. But what is shocking when you meet Tom Tarrant is to know that in the 1960s, he was on America's top 10 most wanted criminals. He was a hardened terrorist. He was absolutely opposed to the civil rights movement. He'd been in prison twice. He'd been shot and left for dead. And yet in prison, reading the New Testament, he came to discover Jesus, and his entire life was transformed. And sitting there looking at this man thinking, you would have never guessed how his life could change. But we believe that Jesus changes people's lives. So again, as we look at people, do we look at them in judgment or in compassion? And do we simply see who people are, or do we see with the eyes of faith what people could become if they were to encounter Jesus? Let's pray that God opens our eyes to see people in that kind of way. Now, before we finish, there's been loads already, but just one very practical thing. How do we do this then? How do we go beyond the theory to practice? How do we help people to encounter Jesus? I think there's one really practical thing in this story that we can really learn from when it comes to being mission-minded and sharing Jesus. And that is a very simple thing. It's called hospitality. Where does this life-changing encounter happen in Zacchaeus's life? It happens in his house. It happens most probably over dinner, although we don't actually read that explicitly, but from what we know of the culture, almost certainly Zacchaeus would have fed Jesus. They would have eaten together. And in fact, again, interesting thing to do, look through Luke's gospel later and look at all the things that happen over a meal. Almost the entire gospel seems to be happening as people are eating. Isn't that interesting? Life-changing encounters don't just happen in church buildings. They can happen over meals. In fact, I'd maybe say they happen more over meals and in homes. And actually, one of the things that's been really tough for the last year has been not being able to do that, hasn't it? You know, Zoom is great. I love the fact we can talk about Jesus. And there's been a wonderful way to be able to communicate Jesus with people who maybe wouldn't come to a church building. And we've been making the most of those opportunities. But the one thing, the massive thing that's been missing is hospitality and community. And isn't it wonderful that from tomorrow, legally, we'll be allowed to do it again? I mean, talk about timing. We'll actually be able to go into people's homes and be inviting others into our homes, because it is often in the home, over a meal, that lives can be transformed, where we embody the gospel. I often say to students, by the way, you know, the reason why we do so many evangelistic events over food is it's not just because we're bribing people to come. Often people think, you know, it's just like if you want to bribe a student to come to an event, give them food. Actually, there's a really significant reason why sharing the gospel over a meal is a really wonderful thing to do. Do you know what? Why? Because one of the most predominant metaphors in the Bible of the kingdom of God is a meal. It's a feast. It's really good food. It's sitting down together and enjoying that. So when we sit down together and enjoy community and hospitality and great food, we're not just meeting people's physical needs. They might have their own homes to eat in, but we're embodying and illustrating the very thing that we're trying to communicate. And that's why it's so powerful. But also notice something else that's interesting. As I mentioned before, Jesus doesn't invite Zacchaeus to his house. Jesus invites himself to Zacchaeus' house. Zacchaeus' house, that's a mouthful, isn't it? And I find that interesting because although we said, you know, maybe in that culture it was different, I think there's something to be learned from that. So often as Christians, we think that we have to be the one to always offer the hospitality, to always be the one to help others. And it's great to do that. But also be willing to receive the hospitality of others and to be helped by others. We see that in Jesus' life a number of times, don't we? Not just here. Think of the woman at the well in John chapter 4. It's not Jesus offering her a drink, it's Jesus asking her for a drink. And sometimes when we receive the help and the hospitality of others, we can develop trust and relationship perhaps even more quickly than if we're just the ones trying to do it for them. So be willing to be invited to other people's house for dinner. But also be willing to ask other people for help. It's a wonderful way of getting to know people. Again, living in the block of flats that we ran in, we got to know quite a few of our neighbours just by asking for help, by asking to borrow a saucepan when I first moved in, a wooden spoon, bizarrely, when ours broke. We didn't ask to borrow a BMW, but one of our neighbours lent us their BMW when our car was in for service a few months.